Our next case this morning is number 07-2455, the United States against Daniel W. Curry. Mr. Crawford.
May it please the court, your honors, Jack Crawford on behalf of the defendant appellant Daniel W. Curry. Your honors, Mr. Curry appeals his conviction for four counts of armed bank robbery and four counts of use of a firearm in relation to a crime of violence on several grounds, the most important of which is that Mr. Curry contends that his right to a fair trial was denied to him when the district court judge commented to the jury about the respective credibility and honesty of witnesses, especially of the defendant himself. Originally, this was an indictment of two persons, Arthur Curry and Daniel Curry, two brothers. Arthur Curry entered a plea of guilty on his charges. Mr. Curry's defense, in the face of admittedly substantial circumstantial evidence, was to blame his brother for all of the robberies that occurred and the incriminating evidence found in Mr. Curry's locker by the government. In essence, to contend that indeed the robberies were committed by two persons. One of those persons was Daniel Curry's brother, Arthur, and the second person was an individual unknown. That was his defense. And in fact, he testified to all of those aspects of blaming his brother for this crime. A juror raised a question to the court about hearsay, and the district judge decided to take it upon himself to address the entire jury panel on this question and this subject. And in so doing, Mr. Curry submits, your honors, that the district court made a grievous error in choosing an example to give to the jury about hearsay. Indeed, an example of this is not really applicable to hearsay. The most important language is as follows. If you have got two kids, and one of them, you don't know which one, took the peanut butter out of your kitchen, and you have got the two kids standing there, and the one kid said, well, he took it, can you rely on that as a trustworthy statement? No. Your honors, this admonition followed the testimony of the defendant himself, in which basically he pointed to his brother Arthur Curry and said, he took it. He's the one that stole thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars from various central Indiana banks. The example is ill-suited even in the sense that this is not an example of hearsay. I don't know where or how the judge came up with this example. In this example, the trier of fact, which I would submit is fair to infer, is a parent. The government in its brief says, well, we don't really know if this is about two brothers. Well, the judge's example says, you have got two kids stealing peanut butter out of your kitchen. I think it's a fair inference that they're siblings at least. And in this example, it has nothing to do with hearsay. The judge tells the jury, you've got the two kids standing there. And the one kid says, well, he took it. Both witnesses are present before the trier of fact in this example, to wit, the parent. And so it's not really about hearsay at all. And then he adds, can you rely on that as a trustworthy statement? No. Your honors, that is a direct comment on the defendant's substantial testimony that his brother took the money. I don't know any other way to read the judge's comment.
In your opinion, was there any curative instructions that would have saved this case after Judge McKinney made the initial error?
No, Your Honor. The toothpaste was out of the tube. I don't think there was anything the court could have done, unless perhaps once the court realized its error, it could have said that this example was not applicable, even to hearsay, and anything to the facts of this case. Perhaps the court could have said that, but it didn't. It continued on and talked about comments that we don't want, such as he stole, he took the peanut butter. We don't want those comments. And then, of course, the court went on to talk about the testimony of the bank tellers, saying that testimony was trustworthy. There were numerous bank tellers in the course of these four bank robberies who testified, I think as many as 13 of them. And in essence, the judge is telling the jury, while trying to explain hearsay, the judge concentrated on trustworthiness, but that drifted over into credibility and honesty. The government's witnesses can be believed. The defendant cannot be believed. The example the court gave was more a comment on believability of a witness, insofar as when a witness blames someone else or shifts blame, that's not deserving of credibility. That had nothing to do with hearsay. And I think it's interesting to note, Your Honors, that in the sidebar conference or the conference outside the presence of the jury with counsel, District Judge McKinney said he was going to give a different example. He said he was going to tell the jury about a story of a minister saying that one of his parishioners told the minister it was raining outside. And the judge said, well, that evidence wouldn't be as credible as if the fact finder saw the parishioner drenched with water. That would be more consistent. And the minister, even though he's a minister, can't be given credibility because it would be a hearsay statement about his parishioner. That's the example the judge said he was going to tell the jury. And then he came up with this other example, and I think he even indicated that he was concerned afterwards about giving this example, that perhaps he had prejudiced the jury. He tried to correct it, but I think by doing so, he dug the hole deeper and, in essence, deprived this defendant of his right to have the jury consider his testimony fairly without a judicial comment on its honesty. And I think that the jeopardy is serious, Judge. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case. But the defendant testified he was entitled to have that jury view his testimony according to the court's instructions without an implication that the court disbelieved him because he blamed someone else for the crime.
Well, how did he explain having all this money on his person?
He said his brother put it in his storage locker, Judge. He had an explanation for everything. He said that the duffel bag with his name on it that had the disguises in it, his brother took that to North Carolina and brought it back and put it in Daniel Curry's storage locker. He said Arthur Curry put the safe in Daniel Curry's storage locker. Arthur Curry put the gun in there. Arthur Curry put $131,000 of red dye-stained money in there. He had an explanation for everything, and the total explanation was to point the finger at his brother Arthur. He even identified Arthur from the pictures as the person involved in the robbery. One guy looks like Arthur, the other guy, I don't know who it is. But he had an explanation for everything. And evaluating that explanation could have been done by the finder of fact, certainly, and found against the defendant. But when a judge says, right at the close of the case, you can't believe somebody who blames someone else, I think that really interferes with that jury's ability to judge the case themselves rather than to be influenced by how they think the court feels about that testimony. Your Honors, as to the second item we raised, the search of Mr. Curry's storage locker, I would ask the court to look at the affidavit carefully. In essence, the affidavit in support of the search warrant from Special Agent Rock basically says that a man named Daniel Curry was passing and spending a lot of red money throughout central and southern Indiana. That's about all it says. It doesn't say that the serial numbers on that money was connected to the money stolen from the Midwestern banks.
No, but they did talk about it. There were further details. Talked about Curry's use of a motel room near the victim bank, the theft of a car near the motel, the disposal of a red stained bank bag. There were a few more details.
There were a few more, Judge, yes. But I think it's a little thin. If a person is, what if an individual is known to be passing money that's counterfeit in various places? Does that give the court the right to authorize a search of his house or his locker? I'm not sure it does, because there has to be a knowledge and intent that indeed the money is either stolen or the money is counterfeit, and I do not think it satisfies the reliable, credible evidence necessary for the issuance of the warrant. And I reserve the rest of my time for response, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Wharton.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is James Wharton. I represent the government here today, as I did before the district court. Let me focus most pointedly with respect to the first issue, the one that Mr. Crawford dealt most of his time upon. And I think it's important, Your Honors, to consider the context of how this question was raised, and it was this. Many tellers had testified in this trial, and they were permitted, over sometimes hearsay objections, to testify about what other tellers said during the robbery and what the perpetrators of the robbery said during the robberies. Then later, the defendant testified, and he offered to testify about things his brother, Arthur Curry, who had been the co-defendant, said to him. And the hearsay objections as to that were granted, and that testimony then, of course, was not admitted, consistent in both cases with the law about hearsay. That's important to understand the logic behind the juror's question. And so then one of the jurors sent a written question to the district judge asking for an explanation about hearsay and referenced both of those matters. That is, why were the tellers allowed to testify about what they heard during the robberies, but the defendant wasn't allowed to testify about what his brother said? That's the background. Now, let me say carefully and respectfully, Judge McKinney's response was at best inartful. It was not well prepared. And I agree with Mr. Crawford that it responded more to a question of credibility, which of course is part of hearsay, but it didn't focus on the rules of hearsay, it focused more on credibility. But there's nothing in what he said that is wrong. There's nothing in what he said that specifically commented on the testimony of any particular witnesses in the trial. He didn't talk about brothers, as the appellant contends. Under the worst case scenario, this was inartful and confusing to the jury.
Well,
and I'm sorry, Ryan. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm going to finish, but I'll let you ask your
okay.
question. Mr. Crawford, then, on behalf of the defendant, made a motion for a mistrial, which was not a spurious motion. But the critical part of this is then Judge McKinney gave a curative instruction, and that's cited in my brief on page 17. And the exact issues that are complained about today are exactly what Judge McKinney focused on. And I'm quoting from this. I'll tell you this in my final instructions. Any comment that I make or anything that I say is not designed to tell you how to come out in this case. I'm telling you how the hearsay rule works as best I can. I'm not telling you who to believe and who to disbelieve. And he goes on in some detail about that. And then he gives this court's approved litany of instructions that deal with these issues in many different forms. And in the final instructions, he focuses many times on the fact that credibility of witnesses is the province of the jury, not of the court. Don't draw any conclusions from rulings I made. Don't draw any conclusions from things I've said. He tells the jury, credibility is your decision. Now, another important point here is this. That's the timing of when this happened. The case was not over. If this question had come up during the jury's deliberation, that would be a different situation. But the defendant had not even rested when this question and this response by the district court was made. Mr. Curry could have presented some other evidence. He could have asked to be recalled to testify. There were many avenues available to him. And, very importantly, very competent counsel Mr. Crawford, who also appeared in the district court, had the opportunity to argue these matters in his final instructions. The jury was not in his final argument. The jury was not deliberating yet. And, in fact, these issues of credibility were argued to the jury. So it's the government's position that there is no error. It's inartful, but it's not erroneous.
Well, me now, yes?
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I know you didn't. Judges, trial judges, wield so much influence over juries. They have to be incredibly careful not to ever comment on a defendant's credibility, or anyone's credibility, for that matter. That's the province of the jury. In this case, the troubling term that Judge McKinney used was trustworthiness. Look, we're lawyers. We can look back and see what he was getting at. He essentially told the jury that the testimony of the bank tellers was trustworthy. And the testimony of the two brothers, you know, who are pinning the crime on each other, was inherently untrustworthy.
I respectfully disagree. I don't think he said that.
First of all, he was telling the jury that they're permitted to hear statements if a judge deems them trustworthy. His comment about hearing from other testimony, the more trustworthy it is directly contrary to the idea that a jury may choose to believe one person over the contradictory testimony of a hundred other individuals. And as for that curative instruction, he did try, you know, to emphasize the credibility determinations were for the jury to make, but he goes on to use the word trustworthy again. So he essentially states that the bank teller's statements have met some threshold of trustworthiness, but the defendant and his brother's statements have not. And, of course, it was a very short trial, beginning on March 5th. Curry's found guilty on March 8th.
I understand, Your Honor. Again, let me say there was never any comment about brothers or about any specific person's testimony in the case. You know, what Judge McKinney said first was not helpful to anybody. And I want to, again, try to say that as respectfully as I can. But when he realized that, I think in what he said next, which again is the quote I was referring to, he's doing his best to explain to them that credibility is fully their decision. And again, it's critical because the case hasn't even finished yet, let alone them starting their deliberation. And then he gave, with no objection from the defendant about this, in fact, the defendant joined in these, he gave the final instructions that deal very strongly with these issues. And, of course, the jury is presumed to having followed these instructions.
Well, I have to tell you, I sat and thought and thought and thought. You know, I was a trial judge for a lot of years. You know, what would I have done to undo what I had done? And I decided I would go back in chambers and cry. So,
well, and I don't know whether Judge McKinney did that or not. But let me say this. This court, logically, I respectfully suggest, favors efforts at curative instructions rather than granting mistrials when a trial is three-fourths of the way through, which it was here. Now, what overrides all of this, though, is at worst, if Your Honor is suggesting this was erroneous, if this was error, it's clearly harmless. I mean, the evidence in this case is so overwhelming as to Daniel Curry's guilt. He was not substantially denied his rights. He was not denied a fair trial. Beyond what has already been raised on the record by the judges about that, the two items in two of these robberies were found with his DNA on them without any explanation otherwise. A mustache, a facial hair that was worn in one of the robberies. He was the sole contributor to the DNA, and he was the major contributor to a glove that was used in one of the robberies found in one of the switch cars. Besides the evidence of him having a gun that was stolen related to the first robbery, I mean, the evidence was strong. And let me say this, Judge Robner, particularly to you since you asked these questions. Here's what's really critical about this. I want you to think about this, I respectfully suggest. These tellers, none of them identified Daniel Curry. Now, if that had been the case, I think your point is stronger. In other words, if they had said, that's the man who robbed me, none of them could. These were excellent robbers. They were fully disguised. No one could ID them. The case was wholly circumstantial. So to say the tellers are trustworthy, that means is, yeah, they got robbed, which was never contested. These are real bank robberies. But they didn't say Daniel Curry's the person that robbed me. I think then we might have a different road to go down. And I think that's really important for you to consider. Let me respond then. Unless there's other questions about that, I'll respond to the second matter, which is the motion to suppress. Again, there was some reference by Judge Romer about those matters, and specifically, very importantly, about the dye-stained red bag, which clearly ties to the red dye-stained money, and then Curry moving back and forth between his house and the storage locker. I see my time's up, but real quickly, even if this court were to find there wasn't probable cause, the appellant doesn't even bring up the Leon test, and clearly, under the Leon standard of good faith, there'd be no basis to suppress this evidence. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Warden.
Thank you, Mr. Warden. How much time does Mr. Crawford have? Sir, you have a minute left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, indeed, when Judge McKinney, who is an excellent and experienced trial judge, he was both a state trial judge and now, of course, a federal district court judge, when I moved for the mistrial after his comments to the jury, we did a sidebar, and I confronted Judge McKinney with my feelings about his comments to the jury. And indeed, I think at that point, he recognized the severity of what he had said. And he blanched white and leaned over and said, quote, "That is the last thing I wanted to. I hope I didn't really do that." It had been a 4 or 5 day trial, not overly lengthy, but certainly hadn't used that much of the court's time. And I think the judge recognized that this was an imprudent statement he made to the jury. And I don't know where, once again, it differed from the example he gave only moments before, where it came from. I think it's important that although the tellers didn't identify Curry, they offered some substantive evidence concerning the nature of the crimes, bank strap numbers, the appearances of the defendants that supported the government's case.
Mr. Crawford, your time
has
expired.
Thank you, Judge. Thank
you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Crawford, you serve by appointment of the court. You have our deep thanks for your very fine efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement.